I pledge allegiance to the flag of the United States of America and to the republic for which it stands, one nation, under God, indivisible, with liberty and justice for all.
Thank you.
Justin
and Mitchell. I don't think we need to do a roll because this is just a committee meeting, so we'll just make note of who's here. And thank you for coming, Nate.
Oh, absolutely.
Congratulations again.
Well, thank you.
Before we get started, there was a couple of things that I actually got from Boyd. And it concerns a couple of the things, I'll get copies to you, all of you and stuff. Nate, he'd actually had emailed Nate back in July.
Back in July, yeah.
And I had sent him an email basically to Boyd saying, make sure you send it to the planning board, not to, right, directly to Nate, because we've got the subcommittee working on things and things like that. He did have a couple of things on there that will probably have to be addressed in the final report.
So no, Rudy, can I just ask him, is he asking the question as a select board member, a ZBA member, or just a member of the public?
Let me see here. Let me see how he put it in here. He had originally sent it as a selectman town of Candia. So there was a couple of things. Actually, there was two different letters, and I'll get them so that everybody's got a copy.
Technically, that should have gone to me, shouldn't it?
Yes, as the liaison to liaison, yeah. But so that was the first one, and I said, I didn't have any problem with people giving comments.
Otherwise,
to the
what's
board,
the sense of me being here?
Right, it should have gone to you.
We love you, Brian.
Huh?
We love
you. This was a point for Boyd, though.
Yeah. So the first one was on July 19th, and I'll just read it. So none of the previous zoning amendments proposed for the village district were to be adopted under RSA 674.21 and 2. Innovative land use controls, yet the current proposal includes that language. Why is this provision included in the revision? What are the advantages to the town? And actually, Nate had responded to that one that
It was in Carol's original language. I think Boyd was under the impression that was new language.
Right.
And it was in Carol's original report, so it wasn't new.
Yeah.
But
and then
one comment I'd like to make about that, though, I think it was Brian and Mark that were vocal about making sure that the planning board had as much control as possible versus the ZBA.
Correct.
You know?
Correct.
And that was what we kind of...
Yeah, so we could maintain
we were pretty
the
strong.
Yeah, exactly. Exactly. The second one, the original village district was in excess of 800 acres, while a subsequent revision proposed some 200 acres. There are now some reports that the district encompasses a 1,000-foot circle projecting 500 feet in either direction from four corners. Is this correct? What is the proposed size of the district? Is there a district within a district? And Nate had responded to that no, it's
239.02 acres. And I think he was just a little confused. I think when the
buffer zone.
About the buffer zone.
Right, the buffer zone.
Yeah. So kind of explained that to him.
Okay. Let me see. Then the entire village district is approved by the voters with the provisions that the section is adopted under RSA 674:2, section 1 and 2, innovative land use controls. Will the waiver provisions in section 504.10 of our ordinance apply to all uses within the district? Currently, the table of use regulations indicates that only the uses designated with a C are permitted only by conditional use permit. Will only those uses be subject to the waiver provisions of 504.10, or will all of the uses in the district be eligible for relief under the waiver provisions? And I think that goes along with what you were just talking about, too, is that the answer to that would probably be yes.
I think I remember responding to this one, too, and it I think that section... I don't have actually the regs in front of me, but that section 5.04 it's a section of the regs that deal exclusively with conditional use permits, so that wouldn't relate to anything but a conditional use permit. So I think he was concerned that waiver provision would apply to other things beyond what's identified with a C in here, and I don't see how that would be the case.
So again, as, I'm just want, you know, the point I'd like to make is that, you know, we got a long history going on with all this zoning stuff and just absolute warfare and fighting every time that we have a discussion about it. So now here's Boyd. It's just hard for me. Is this good, you know, is this goodwill? I mean, he's looking at this thing, and the first thing I think of is like, all right, what's he, you know, I mean, he's doing this as a select board member, as a ZBA member, as a member of the public. I don't know. Mm. You know, what yep. Why does he, when we were doing the map, we had the master plan committee, and I showed up late one time, and he was sitting there, and he was dictating exactly what the vision statement was going to be to say after we had a couple of women on the committee come up with their own thing.
That.
Remember okay. that?
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah, and then when I got here, I said, what's going on here? I said, I have a little problem with the process, and so at the time it was Jack Munn. He said, yeah, I do too, and you know, Boyd took all his books and stuff and went home. So I just don't know where he gets. He comes to the meeting, and if he's sitting over there, next thing you know, everybody's talking to him. I mean, he's not on the planning board. He has nothing to do with this. If he's got a question, talk to, you know, but he has a very intense, let me say intense, interest in anything to do with zoning, and he has one mission when it comes to that. I've just been through this.
Mm-hmm.
Oh, as anybody that knows me knows, and what I've just been through with this whole situation. So I'm just like, yep. You know, we're trying to do good planning here. We're right. trying to sit around and do good planning. Now we're sitting here with him. Right. Well, how are we going to appease Boyd? How are we going to appease him? It's like, you know.
No, I just want to bring this up just because it was submitted, so I want the board to be aware of what was going on. Not to discount anything you're saying, Scott, because
no, that you did the right thing, Brandon.
No, I agree, but I'm just it's just like
understood.
You know, you know where I'm coming from, Rudy.
Understood.
You got to see some of this stuff firsthand.
These things, like I said, these things. I don't have a problem with people submitting things and writing questions to the board mm-hmm. or to the subcommittee. But my problem was is that it went to Nate, and the board is.
Right.
paying for Nate as our consultant.
Nate's
here.
Only accountable to us at this point.
Yeah, exactly. I take my direction from the board. Right. And I kind of, Boyd has emailed me about other things, you know, correct. Unrelated to this project in the past, and I just kind of am used to answering questions when they come in. So I answered these questions, and then I forwarded them to Rudy, and Rudy's like, well, they should come to the board. And I was like, yes, right. they should.
So they're not anything that we really need to address. I just want to make sure that everybody's up to speed on mm-hmm. what's going on.
So quick question, Rudy. So yeah. do we have Nate's response back to the question?
We do. Yes.
I forwarded that to yes. Rudy, and I think Rudy forwarded that to the whole board as well.
I thought that I did, but I might not have. But what I will do is I thought I had a copy of it here, but I will make sure that I get everything to you. I wanted to bring it up at a meeting yep. before I sent it all out so everybody knew what the history was.
And I just asked because this. If it comes up again...
Right.
I just want to make sure that we're all in the loop as far as what was brought up and how it was addressed, because it sounds like
what
most of those concerns
letter?
Were things that were either
this
in
one?
The plan
this one?
Yeah,
or
I,
it should be inconsequential
letter
if
was
we come together.
I thought Boyd's questions, at least the one I've only seen, the only email I got was the one from July 19th that Rudy's discussing, right. and I think there were four questions with that. They all seemed pretty straightforward questions.
Okay.
So.
I do have... Nate's response. So what I'll do is I'll have Lisa, before tonight's meeting, I'll have her copy everything. So you'll
okay,
have a copy
great.
Of it.
I have not seen any other questions from Boyd or anybody else
on
this since July 19th.
Right.
So.
Okay.
And in
thanks.
The future, you'll end up referring him to Rudy anyway.
Yes. Well, and Rudy's made that clear to Boyd okay. as well. So.
Yeah. So everything is there. Oh, this is actually Nate's responses to it.
I think I remember seeing it. Did you email it to all of us?
I think Rudy forwarded it. I forwarded it to Rudy, and I think Rudy sent it to the board.
I thought that
I read
did.
Boyd's
Hi.
Questions and
yeah.
then his answers,
yeah.
and I thought
Rudy?
That was the... I think
okay.
that
may I be excused?
Yes, go ahead. Yes. Let's make a note that Fox is used.
I'll take a look. I probably have them. If you sent them out, I should have them.
Well, I can, like I said, I mean, I've got hard copies of here that I pulled out just so I make sure they had them. So,
I'll get a copy for everybody
yeah.
if you have it.
Okay. And his other question had to do with the statement that was in there about that the master plan talking about establishing separate zoning districts for Four Corners areas and mixed moderate density residential and small scale commercial use, you know, the things that we had in there. He wanted to know where it was, so I actually sent him out an email today telling him exactly where in the regs. Or in the master plan, it refers to the fact that this is what we're supposed to do in the master plan is innovative stuff, and the Village District was one of them, so.
Okay.
I'll give you a copy of that, too. So that's, just wanted to get you an update on that, and noting the fact that I did have Nate, and I did tell Boyd that he has to go through the committee, or the, yeah, the committee, or the board, or the subcommittee to do that.
Well, Rudy, if we genuinely felt like we had an ally in planning, it would be one thing. But when you have somebody who repeatedly, day in and day out, year after year, has taken a certain course, I mean, there's no goodwill there at all, Rudy.
Well,
anything we do, always everything, and here we are, we've got 10 minutes into this meeting, and it's above board. Think about it.
I just want to make sure that,
you know,
I've let him
send
know.
Send Brian.
Right. I let him, are you back, or?
No, that was just a...
Oh, okay.
Something I had to deal with work.
All right. I just wanted to let you know that there was communications that were done between Boyd and Nate from Southern New Hampshire Planning, and that I've made it clear that everything needs to come through the board, through either Lisa, or, I mean, you know, he can talk to anybody on the board, that's no problem, but it needs to be basically done in a public meeting, whether it's a public meeting or a public hearing, that everything needs to be discussed out there, so.
Yeah, and Boyd, you know, like I say, Boyd emails, you know, every once in a while, you know, do you have a copy of this plan or this document or whatever the case may be, you know, not necessarily about this project, but other things. And
right.
I've always been, you know, quick to respond to him, and I just sort of responded to this, not thinking of it, and then realized afterwards that, yeah, it everything should come through Rudy and the board, so.
Right.
So, but I have not seen anything else since.
I'd like to... There's one thing I'd like to bring up, because this has been going on a long time. There was work done by Southern New Hampshire Planning and looking at the problems we had with workforce housing. And so Boyd in Southern New Hampshire Planning said, you know, you're not doing your fair share, we've got to do something about it. And so Boyd's like going absolutely out of his mind. So he calls a meeting with Southern, he just calls me up. Hey, Scott, I got all this figured out. I got the whole thing figured out. I got all this workforce housing thing figured out. Can you come down to the town today? I got Southern New Hampshire Planning coming down. So Sylvia Von Ollick comes down. David Priest couldn't be there. And were you at that one?
No, it would have been before
Jack,
my time.
Oh, yeah, it was before you. It was Jack Munn. And so they sat there and they explained to, and so Boyd went through the whole thing and wanted to tell Southern New Hampshire Planning that we were all set with that. We were satisfying the requirement that state law is clear about. And they sat there and they talked to him for 15 minutes and said, no, you're absolutely wrong. And then he went into a tirade and ended up leaving. So, I mean, it's what I'm saying. So under what capacity did he arrange that meeting?
Well, I don't want to...
No, but I'm just trying to say that we've
right.
got...
But I
we've got a situ. We got a situation, and one more thing. It comes back to planning. When we were doing the everything about the vision statement, when you look at towns like Bedford and Amherst and Wyndham, they all talk about a diversity of housing because it's state law. So they all put it in their vision statement. Well, Boyd was so out of his mind about our vision statement saying anything about that, he was going absolutely crazy. Called Southern New Hampshire Planning, talked to Jack Munn's boss at that time. He was very dissatisfied with the job that Jack Munn was doing, is particularly with regard to this vision statement. So what I'm saying is we've got a clear pattern of behavior.
Right, but I understand what you're saying.
No, you understand what I'm saying, but I don't know if you do, Rudy.
This is not the venue for that. I want to get back to the Village thing.
Again, I'm just saying, you know, we've got a pattern of somebody getting involved in planning board business, and they shouldn't be.
Right.
Trying to use their power to influence what happens in planning, and I'm saying that, and here we go again. I've been through all these meetings for years, Rudy, and it's been one, you know, consistently. So I'm just saying, you know, we're here to do good planning. Let's do that.
Understood.
And if he, you know, send him to Brian. You know, he's got no. Every time he does something, again, I always ask, under what authority?
Yeah. And that's why, you know, I wanted to bring it up, but I don't want to spend a lot of time on it. But I want to kind of keep your comments in the back burner for a little while, Scott, because I think it's going to come up again. But I just wanted to get the update, or give you the update on that. There's a few things that had happened on this one that I wanted to make sure that everybody's clear on. So.
Rudy, have you gotten any other questions, that, you know, aside anybody else in town about you know, what the stipulations are, or, you know, any of the draft language or anything like that?
No. Okay. No, because most of the townsfolk know that we're working on it as a draft.
Yep.
And then once we feel comfortable that we've got something that we can actually get some public input in, then we'll do it as a public input.
Sure.
I'm just excited about getting the public.
Yeah.
The public session going, that thing.
Right. Right. And then that way, that's where all of the comments should be being made by anybody, whether it be, well, if it's coming from the select board, it should be coming through Brian.
Right.
But anybody can sit out there
as
a public citizen.
He can sit out there and represent himself as a citizen.
Right.
It's fine.
So, but and I can assure you that we have other things that we'll be working with Stantec and New Hampshire Southern New Hampshire Planning on, is that I will make sure that there's no contacts that are being made outside of the board or the representatives of the board to Southern New Hampshire, and I know that Nate is well on board with that.
Yeah, no, that makes my life easier. That's, yeah, that's certainly no issue. It's we're just always in the habit of answering questions,
right,
when they come.
Right, yeah. Right, right. And but as Scott said, we want to make sure that there's no representation being made by anybody other than the seven members of the board and Lisa.
Yep.
For contact.
Right.
So. All right. Good. Okay. Sorry to spend
no,
the first
no problem.
15 minutes.
All right. Let's talk Four Corners District. I was going to do a whole PowerPoint. I did a PowerPoint, but I'm going to spare you all setting up and tearing down the screen before 7 o'clock, and we'll just... I printed out full slides, and we can just sort of use it as a handout. Might actually be.
I
made some extras, assuming that there might be members of the public here that might be interested. But so let's talk a little bit. So I lost 2 weeks of the last month for good reasons. So
I guess we'll forgive you for that.
But I do have some preliminary results to share, and you know, really, what I want to do is talk about our analysis of development potential and how we developed that, what assumptions we used, and if you think we're on the right track or not. And if you think we're on the right track, great. We'll proceed and refine this into a report and do the fiscal analysis. And if you think something needs to be tweaked, now would be the time to tweak it before we start rolling this out to the public. So
great.
First couple of slides are just sort of history reminder. You guys know we did not invent this wheel. This wheel was started by Carol Ogilvy and her work with the MTAG grant. We used that as a starting point for this. Mm-hmm. We made tweaks to it, obviously, you know, I want to always pay, you know, a nod to Carol's work and the work that she did to kind of get the ball rolling on this. And make sure that she gets credit for all of the work that she did. So I'm probably going to start off every public presentation about this with a nod to her and her work to make sure that... and then just sort of, you know, as a... During that public process, when the MTAG project was rolled out, obviously, you know, the concerns really related to the size of the district, and that, you know, some people felt like the stipulations that were proposed would not result in development that was characteristic of a rural village center. And so we sort of took another look at this through those two lenses. And this is all stuff that you guys know. So purposes of the Four Corners District. We reviewed these with the committee early on in the process, and everybody verified that these three purposes were correct. So allowing mixed moderate density residential and small scale commercial uses compatible with the village setting, permitting new development, redevelopment, and infill construction that increases the economic viability of the Four Corners area, allowing for a range of housing types and sizes that can accommodate the current and future needs of residents at all life stages and income levels. The boundaries of the district were substantially reduced. You all came up with these boundaries. You rolled up your sleeves with a big map on the table and really thought hard about what boundaries made sense. And we ended up revising the district, downsizing the district to 239 acres, 239.02 acres to be exact. But that was in direct response to some of the concerns that were raised during the public process with Carol Ogilvy.
Nate, do we make any distinction between the Four Corners District and the Four Corners area? Or do they mean the same thing?
They mean the same thing in this context.
Okay.
Although we could always, you know, change area to district.
It might be better, I think. That's a good point.
Because when you look at it, it almost feels like you're talking about two different things. And I don't know how many times we reference either district versus area, but someone who hasn't been involved may look at that and say, you know,
what's the difference?
Are you talking about two different things?
Yeah, good point. Good point.
So I kind of have a few slides here where, and these are really kind of a primer for the public presentation, where really trying to demonstrate how the board responded to the comments and concerns that were expressed during the last process. So one of the concerns that was expressed was ensuring that what actually happened in the Four Corners area was actually mixed use. Mm-hmm. And so this next slide explains kind of the 500-foot concept and how there would be mixed use would be required in that area. One thing that I noticed is the intention of that 500-foot area that would be that buildings or lots developed within that would solely for residential uses would be special exceptions. And I, as I looked back through the language in this, and I can give does everybody have a copy of this? The footnote number 3. Footnote number 1 on this page. Buildings or lots in the Four Corners District developed solely for residential uses shall be located a minimum of 500 feet from Route 27, 43, and Raymond Road. I would recommend that we add the phrase unless permitted by special exception at the end of that. I think you want to have some relief valve for there to be a solely residential use if it was determined to be acceptable through the special exception process. I think that was the intention of that, and we just didn't include that phrase. Is anybody opposed to that?
Well, I think, you know, as I've been thinking about this ordinance, you think about testing it out. You think about, for instance, if you go west of the Four Corners and you go up where Zhang's house is, and if somebody say did something there, we might, as a planning board, somebody might come in with an idea. We might look at that and say, well, no, we don't want to make you do commercial, because it's it's a very small thing. There's little specific things, but when you say by special exception, shouldn't that be by some sort of waiver process with the planning board is what a special exception to apply ZBA, and I think that is at the, issue.
I think what we're, that's a good point, because I think what we're trying to do is the same thing we did with the over 55 housing ordinance.
Do it through conditional use permit?
This board would have the authority to guide what's going on in there.
Right.
The other interesting part about that, too, is that that house could be considered a historical house, too. So we'd need to have some flexibility in what, to allow in there, too. Good point.
When you look under 674:21, innovative land use controls, and you look at, H, performance standards, and I, flexible and discretionary zoning, I really think that when somebody comes, we can't anticipate everything that's going to happen. But I think we can trust that we have a reasonable board that can look at something and say, hey, you know what, even though I think the ordinance should be considered a guideline. This is a good attempt, but we have to have a mechanism for flexibility. And
so instead of saying would be permitted only by special exception, you'd say would be permitted by only by conditional use permit.
Yeah,
exactly.
Yeah.
Okay, so what did you change it to?
So right here, instead
unless
of
permitted
by conditional use
conditional permit. Use. Okay.
Yeah, because this, in my opinion, this is going to be an innovative land use project, so we can do that.
So we're going to include that same phrase at the end. That just builds flexibility for the board.
Right.
Rather than saying nothing that's exclusively residential can ever happen within 500 feet, it gives you a valve to determine, okay, this does make sense to have.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. I think the board's pretty big on wanting to make sure we have a lot of flexibility in that area, not have to go through hoops and barrels.
Okay. Next page, I talk about the, one of the concerns that was raised was during the public process in 2018 was that the development that would happen would not be reflective of kind of the form of a rural village. And so in this, I explain the maximum front setback and how that pulls buildings closer to the road and more in line with a village center, and the maximum building footprint to kind of, you know, assuage any fears that Walmart or whatever may be coming to the Four Corners District. 10,000 square feet sets that maximum building footprint, and we talked a lot about that. So that's what this. I'm going through this quickly because you guys know this stuff. These are really slides that I put in to kind of as primers for a public presentation.
Right.
So I want to repeatedly drive home how the board has adapted this. You know, has adapted the work that Carol Ogilvie did based on the public feedback and how what, you know, the public is seeing here reflects those comments and concerns. So this may sound repetitive and you've heard some of this before, but this is just stuff that we want to make sure that we're repeatedly making sure the public is aware of.
Just so you know, too, I read the charrette again today that was done back in 2001,
the charrette.
Was it 2001? And a lot of the things that we came up with in here are also reflected in that original charrette, with parking behind and things like that. So we're still on the same wavelength for everything that's been done since then.
Mm-hmm. There were a lot of people that worked on that, and a lot of them really aren't. They're not either, you know, with us, or they're not really too involved. And when I look back at all the people that got involved in that, and then it sat, but we, you know,
and that's why we're pulling it.
Yeah, they really did. I mean, a lot of the things that they figured a lot of things back out.
The next slide, I talk about the building form provisions that we put in, kind of making sure that it looks, the buildings that are constructed look like a rural village center. So the building materials provision that we put in there, the pitched roof provision, although, of course, the board has flexibility to determine that a pitched roof is not feasible or aesthetically pleasing, then doesn't have to be pitched, but the board has to make that determination. So the default is that an applicant's going to come in with a building that's a pitched roof.
Yeah.
And
didn't we have something in that last section there about the 30% and the 20% that allowed us flexibility too?
Let's see.
I know we thought the 20% was too low and 30 was probably, but I thought we would.
Yes, you do. In cases where the planning board determines that achieving the required minimum fenestration is not feasible or aesthetically desirable, the planning board may approve an alternative facade design as a conditional use permit. So yes, there is. I can add. You know, just a note of that language.
It's in the
text. I'm just going to make a note that also applies to this.
Mm-hmm. So you're probably going to do this, but I'd make a suggestion if you're going to utilize some of this or all of this for the public presentation, including pictures of some of the stuff that you showed us when we were choosing with fenestrations and square footage.
Yes, I can do that.
Yeah, because that was very helpful.
For me, anyway. Convinced us when we looked at that one building.
That picture appears a little later on in this presentation. Yeah. But so then, you know, that kind of sets the stage, and we used this as the basis for evaluating what the development potential is. I want to be, you know, clear that this doesn't mean that what we're about to talk about doesn't mean that development is of this scale is going to happen tomorrow. It's just we're looking at what the potential is, what this could set the stage for, realistically. So the first thing we did, and I worked with the subcommittee on this, is we looked at what constraints there were. We looked at that 239-acre district and said, what's not available for development? What's off the table? What are our constraints? And quickly, we identified seven publicly owned lands. publicly owned properties that we went one by one through with our three-person subcommittee and took all of them off the table for obvious reasons. So the assumption here is that the library, the school, the little parcel next to the school with that's owned by the school district with an outbuilding, the fire department, the historical society property with the old schoolhouse, the cemetery, and where we're at right now, the town office parcel, we're assuming those are going to continue to be public uses as they are, and you know, there won't be private development happening on those parcels. And that's what you see on green here. So those are the publicly owned parcels. Then we identified four different properties that we call quasi-public. They may be privately owned, but have a public use associated with them. So we talked quite a bit with our three-person subcommittee about how to treat these and what to assume with these. So the first one on the far left of the graphic, the tiny little pink parcel that abuts the library, that is owned by the heirs of Walter and Mary Davis. That is a, as we'll see on the environmental constraints, that is a very wet property. Mm-hmm. And based on the knowledge of the members of the subcommittee, we're working under assumption that that will eventually become town property.
Let's face it, we wanted to keep Judy happy.
So just fill it in.
This, when we get to the
turtle farm.
Yeah, hey, there we go.
When we show the full we show the full constraint graphic later on, you can't even see this.
You're right, right.
Because
right,
it's completely covered by wetlands and wetlands buffers, so nothing could happen there anyway. So we're assuming that that will become eventually something that gets appended to the library parcel in time. Mm-hmm. The two on the far right are, so in the northeast corner and then the southeast corner, the northeast corner is the courthouse property. Mm-hmm. And the courthouse is actually the Candia South Branch Brook Holdings LLC. So it's a privately owned parcel that has a public use on it. The courthouse is a public use on a privately owned parcel. So what we did here is we carved out the area of that parcel that you see in purple here. That's where the courthouse is on that parcel. So we took that portion of the parcel off the table and said this will continue to be a courthouse. But everything behind it, you know, less environmental constraints, could be developed in the future. Mm-hmm. Same thing on the other side of the road, which is Samowitz and Klein Candia LLC, which is the post office. So we carved out the piece of that parcel where the post office exists. That's what you see in purple here. We said that's going to continue to be a post office. We're going to make that assumption. And everything behind that, that's the rest of that parcel that's privately owned, you see in white here, we're assuming something could happen there. Less environmental constraints. Then we really relied on Rob to advise on the CYAA parcel. And basically what we did there is, I guess we'd call it the Northwest field. I'm not really sure how to refer to it,
yeah.
But the field in the Northwest corner, and then the southern portion of the CYAA parcel, we assumed that something could happen in those two pieces of the CYAA parcel in the future, but that the rest of it, which is what you see in purple here, the rest of the CYAA parcel would basically remain as it is today. Does that make sense?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So when we talk about quasi-public lands, these areas in purple are what we took off the table.
Yeah. Now, should we have a note in there? Because I know you were saying that those could be developed for the benefit of the CYA to raise funds.
Yeah.
I don't know. Should we put that note in there so people don't think we're saying, oh, yeah, we're going to develop this part of the CYA?
I don't know if that's a good thing to do at this point in time.
Just let it.
I think just showing this in here, and if a question comes up, then I think Rob could probably answer that. But.
And I think part of that potential, if you look at the one that's by the road.
Yeah.
So the property that is just to the, is that the northeast of us?
The little guy's practice field, right?
Yeah, so just on the other side of that where M&S Logistics is.
Mm-hmm.
So at one point that was part of the CYA property, right? So we subdivided and sold it off probably 20-something years ago, and we used those funds to help kind of, you know, invest in the building.
Oh, yeah.
You know, I don't know, could we potentially sell off that front property as a you know, developable land in the new Four Corners district that could eventually raise more money for us to do something else?
Mm.
I don't know if we would, but I think that's the point of that piece of property.
Theoretically,
the further one down, that would probably be CYA only development.
Yeah.
I don't think we can get that to anyone else.
So, and the next slide just sort of explains what I just explained.
That arm down there that you own, you could probably have that as the ice arena. And the
we'd love to have an ice arena, really. One other question, Nate. When we do the maps like this, is there any way we can reference which parcel is which?
Yeah, I can do that. Okay. I can put a legend or something in there. Yep.
Right.
Yeah.
I mean, again, for us, I think we know where a lot of those are because we've been through it a couple times, but others may not.
Yep.
There, good point.
I'm just going to make a note of that.
They probably just number them.
Yeah, I think what we'd do is we'd have a number with a circle, 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, and then we'd just, instead of bullet points, we'd...
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
Yep.
Yep. The next slide shows environmental constraints. So let me explain the environmental constraints here. What you see in brown, the solid brown area, that is poorly drained soil. And the brown, or the reddish brown line around the brown solid area is a 50-foot buffer from poorly drained soils. That's right in the town's regulations. Mm-hmm. No building activity shall occur within 50 feet of poorly drained soil. And you see, we have some poorly drained soil here. Then, if you look at that, remember that parcel that we talked about, the heirs of Walter and Mary Davis?
Mm-hmm.
That's right where that wetland is here. So the hatched area is a wetland, and then we have a stream, you know, running north-south, and a 100-foot buffer around that. So that's, you know, what that blue line is mm-hmm. there.
Where's that stream in relation to where we are?
Right over here, on the other side. Right over there. Yeah, it goes right. Yeah. Okay, and it cuts down around through the. Okay. Oh yeah, yeah. Right, and then when you go to the rest of the cemetery, then you go down the hill by that crypt thing, and then you go over the little stream. Now I remember. Okay, yeah. I knew I was correct. I always said crick. But I think I was saying crypt, the mausoleum thing.
So that has a 100-foot buffer associated with it.
I'm wearing off on you, Judy.
And that's what that blue line is. The solid blue line is a 100-foot buffer from that. The little, on the very western little edge there, that red is a steep slope, or just a piece of a steep slope there.
Mm-hmm.
And according to the town's definition of buildable, in the land use regulation, a steep slope over 25% is not considered buildable in the town of Candia, so we took that little piece off.
That, however, you could blast that and cut that and make it buildable if you wanted to.
Theoretically,
yeah.
But I'm just sticking to
the definition here. It's not a lot of space there, so
it's not really material to the final results.
True.
So the next slide shows all of it together. This is all of those constraints. The publicly owned property, the quasi-public, the four quasi-public properties, the poorly drained soil, the creek with its buffer, and the steep slopes.
Not much buildable, is that?
So,
well, actually, there is
probably,
for what we're looking to do.
Probably like 40%, maybe.
So, well, it lays it out here. So we have 239 total acres. 134.76 of those acres have some level of constraint. So that's 56.4% of the district has some constraint. The unconstrained lands, everything that doesn't have an environmental issue or isn't publicly owned or quasi-public, is 104.26 acres. So 43.6% of the land area.
Now, in actuality, though, too, some of the areas that are in here as constraint lands already have buildings on them.
Yep.
So they can still be used.
Right.
They probably can't be expanded, but they could be reused the way they are. So that would increase that a little bit. Not a heck of a lot, but...
It could, but again, you're probably not going to see expansion there. It would just be a replacement in kind of that use,
but
that square footage.
It still wouldn't allow us to change its use, correct? Or would it?
It would, yes.
It would.
Yes. Mm-hmm. If we, yeah,
because
if we do around
still
here.
Still maintain that flexibility.
Correct. I believe so.
I believe so, too. Like, say the fire station all of a sudden they decided, oh, we're not going to have it there anymore, and then it could become like a little cafe.
Right. Yeah.
But it would still be that square footage.
Right. So, you wouldn't. Yeah.
Right. You wouldn't.
It wouldn't be an expansion.
No, correct. But you could change its use.
Yes.
Okay. As long as that flexibility still exists.
Any questions to this point?
No. Would it be worthwhile to demonstrate that 43.6% on its own? Maybe a separate slide that says, because I think there's still going to be folks who say 239. We still have 104 left that you're going to allow to be this new four corners, almost any type of development, what does that really look like on the map, kind of overlaid?
Oh, yeah.
Well, yeah, I guess we could do that. It's generally the, yeah. I guess it's a little hard to tell what that is. It's the white areas on this graphic.
Yeah. Okay.
And then, yeah, like I said.
Because some of these constraints overlap each other.
Right.
Sometimes
right.
we have more than one constraint. We've got wetland on a public property or you know, whatever the case may be.
Yeah.
But it's the white areas on this.
And then the other thing, too, is like we were just saying, too, I don't think it's necessary to do it now, but we could identify the buildings that are currently existing on those lands that are under constraints, too. I don't think it's worth it to do it right now. It's just, you know, it's just because it's a scope of how actually small it's actually going to be. We're not looking at a huge thing anymore.
Yeah, so yeah, the point is, of that 239-acre district, 104 acres is actually unconstrained.
Yeah.
The rest of it, the other 134 acres has some form of constraint on it that would prohibit development.
Yeah.
Okay.
So when we talk about development potential, this slide is an educational slide. Floor area ratio is the way that we talk about non-residential development and how we calculate what non-residential development potential is. Floor area ratio is the ratio of the total amount of usable floor area of a building, not gross floor area, usable floor area of a building to the total area of the lot that the building is on. So if I had a 20,000 square foot building on a 1 acre lot, my floor area ratio is just under 0.5, because 1 acre is 43,560, and I, you know, my building is 20,000. So 20,000 divided by 43,560 would put me just under 0.5. The floor area ratio, I looked at every non-residential property in the Four Corners area. And calculated all of the floor area ratios for those properties. The average floor area ratio today in the Four Corners District is 0.06. Really low. So basically for every non-residential property in the Four Corners area, there are 6 usable square feet of building space for every 100 square feet of land area. So low intensity uses. There's one, for instance, the storage container property, 33.915 acres. It has a 10,000 square foot building on it. So now a lot of that 33 acre lot has some form of environmental constraint on it. It's not that all of that would be developable, but, you know, we're talking about pretty low floor area ratios. So 0.06 is the average for the entire that exists today in the Four Corners area. The next slide shows this photo, which was one of the kind of guiding images. We very early, you remember I showed different photos of, mm-hmm. of different development around rural villages. So this is from elsewhere in New Hampshire. This is a photo of a mixed-use building. This is on Main Street in the town of Enfield, New Hampshire, which is a town of 4,900 people north of here. This particular building is on a 4/10 of an acre lot. It's got 2,800 feet of non-residential office space on the bottom, and it has two apartment units above it. And when I showed this photo at one of the early meetings, everybody, like a light bulb went off. This is exactly kind of the scope and scale that people envision in the Four Corners area, this exact type of mixed-use development. So it ran the calculation on what...
No pitched roof, but it still
It doesn't have a pitched roof. Looks good. Looks like it fits there.
Right.
It's close to the road.
Get a pitched roof next to it.
Yep. So the floor area ratio, the floor area ratio for this building is 0.16, and it has 2 acre or two units on just under a half acre, so it'd be in that 4 units per acre range. So floor area ratio of 0.16, just to give you a frame of reference, the highest floor area ratio that exists today in the Four Corners district is Charming Fair Place. That is 0.134. So this would be just, slightly higher than Charming Fair Place. The working group, the 3-person working group, we reviewed this and everybody agreed this would be a reasonable build out for the mixed use areas of the Four Corners district. Targeting a floor area ratio of 0.16. And 4 units per acre of residential. That mixture of uses. Right in line with what you see in this photo.
That physically looks fine over here.
That's what a lot of older buildings look like, because they're all flat and connected.
Do they have town water and sewer there? Or is that it's separate?
This does have town water and sewer. This one does. This particular building.
That ratio, that's fine.
Right. Yeah, because it would depend on designing the systems and stuff.
Right.
If it was possible.
So, breaking out let's focus on that 104 acres of unconstrained land in the district that's not publicly owned, that doesn't have environmental constraints. We have extra copies.
We have extras.
Yeah.
And we're on this right here.
Yeah, we're on this
page
here.
Development
probably
assumptions.
About 3/4 of the way through.
Oh, I did touch it. Yeah, two of the notes, yeah.
So now, breaking down that total amount of unconstrained land in the district, within 500 feet there of 2743 and Raymond Road, 60.97 acres of land that's unconstrained. Beyond 500 feet, 43.29 acres. Mm-hmm. So that's how that unconstrained land breaks out. On to the next slide, what we're assuming... based on the guidance from the 3-person working group, is that within 500 feet, that build out that mixed use build out assumption of a floor area ratio of 0.16 with 4 units per acre of residential, and then outside of 500 feet, the assumption is that that's going to be a residential outside of 500 feet, and that would just be built out at 4 units per acre.
Right.
What does that result in? At the development potential for the district as a whole, based on that analysis, looks like 417 dwelling units of housing would be kind of the full development potential within the proposed district. That translates to 953 people, approximately. I made an assumption that half of the new housing would be owner-occupied and half would be renter-occupied, and there are different rates that are the census breaks out owner-occupied rates and owner-occupied number of persons per household in Candia and renter-occupied. I made an assumption that it would be half and half, but probably a fair assumption. Mm-hmm. That would get us, you know, basically that 417 housing units would translate to 953 people. Of those 953 people, there would be approximately 82 school-age children. I know that was one of the questions about how many school-age children. That to develop that number, I had to make another assumption. Russ Tebow, who's an economist here in New Hampshire, has done extensive work about the number of school children generated by development in New Hampshire. His numbers are broken out based on the number of bedrooms in housing units. Mm-hmm. So there's much lower number of school children in one-bedroom units, a little bit higher in two-bedroom units, and then substantially higher for three-bedroom units. So what I did is I just assumed one-third, one-third, and one-third, just for the purpose of you know, an initial estimate here. That one-third of those 417 units would be one-bedroom, one-third of them would be two-bedroom, and one-third of them would be three-bedroom, just kind of as a starting point. And ran that calculation, and that arrives at 82 school-age children. The non-residential portion would be 424,937 square feet of non-residential floor space at build-out. And we can crunch those numbers, you know, a number of different ways in terms of how many jobs that might translate to, and things like that. But before I went too far down that path, I kind of wanted to present this to you and make sure that you guys were okay with the assumptions that were used and kind of how we assumed constraints to development. The next logical step, like I say on the next slide, would be to do the fiscal summary of the build-out analysis and compile a final report and kind of refine those numbers a bit further. So I'm calling this a preliminary presentation of results, but it's really kind of a gut check for everybody here to see if, you know, you agree with those assumptions and want to use those as the basis of finalizing this build-out analysis or whether you want to tweak those assumptions. But that's, you know, based on those assumptions, these are kind of, you know, some initial preliminary figures about what the development potential would be.
What I would be not concerned with, but what I would suggest is having it say that there's the potential for 417 dwelling units, it's got to be made clear in here that that's a long-range plan. Because
yeah.
Looking at it right away is saying, like, okay, there's going to be 953 people living in here next year.
Yeah, that's...
potentially. But that, yeah.
Right. This
no,
is
we're not
a,
taking your place and building that.
Right.
This is a mathematical exercise of what the development potential is.
Right.
Correct.
That doesn't mean that any of this is going to happen tomorrow or next year or 5 years or 10 years from now.
But
put that on here.
Yes.
Right. Mathematical potential.
Yep.
And it's it doesn't include any constraints that we'd have because of the ability of the land to handle water and sewer. So
yeah. We can only do a certain number of permits per year anyway, right?
No, that's been determined to be
unlawful.
Well, it's not illegal, but you have to have a basis for that. And when we had the original one in there for 9 building lots, that's when building was going out of control. So you can do that, but every year you have to reevaluate that and make a determination of why you feel that that's justifiable, and it can be challenged to court if you don't have the right data. So we had to eliminate that.
Do you have any more assumptions that you'll need to make to finish the fiscal summary besides the ones you've already made?
No. I don't need any more assumptions to be able to do that. I just didn't want to spend a lot of time doing that. If, you know, yeah, I wanted to make sure we were on the right track with the assumptions and in the view of the full board before I spent the time and did that portion of the analysis.
I think that's good.
Did you exclude lots where if you look at the structure and you think, well, that nothing's ever going to change?
No.
There, you know, because that's because when I look at that number, I just kind of intuitively, when you look at this land and how it's laid out, I'm like, I don't know how you get to that number, particularly if you look at things that exist. So, like, for instance, like, say, the Viking Oil building, I don't think that gets torn down. Or when Ronnie just renovated that new garage over here, I think you got to make some assumptions about what stayed, what would probably stay and what would, you know.
Yeah, we made no such assumptions that land wouldn't be redeveloped.
The only thing we did as the committee is we said, you know, you have some houses that are really old and stuff, but just like what happened to the Masons Hall up in Northwood, they just caught, it just burnt electrical fire, right? Yeah. So now, do you want to have a constraint on that land that there's no longer, a historical building or anything like that on there? If something did happen, unfortunate, it would be. Yeah. But then you would have a spot where somebody could develop it a little bit right there. You don't want to restrict it.
And remember, Scott, what we're also looking at is the fact that if property gets sold, the property that's currently on, or the building that's currently on there, would probably go away, or the buildings that we were talking about before that might be renovated into there. So it's not really something that's a constraint per se, like the rest of the stuff. I mean, all this stuff that he has in here is definitely a constraint, but something that's existing, is it, you know, maybe someone buys it and says, hey, I want to do one of these village district houses over here. Can I do that? And it's like, okay, I'm going to take this and get rid of this, just say an eyesore or something like that.
The only things that we took off the table, and they're explicitly detailed in each of these slides, is what we knew could not be developed for whatever reason. Right. Publicly owned, it's a cemetery, it's the town office, it's the school, it's a wetland, it's in the wetlands buffer, it's a poorly drained soil, all of those types of things where there was some sort of explicit prohibition on doing something with that property. That's all we took off the table.
I mean,
Scott.
Even the courthouse. I mean, the courthouse used to be in Auburn. That's the only courthouse. Yeah. Right. This, the courthouse could go, hey, you never know.
Private.
Yeah, you don't know.
But I think the only thing is you've got the change that we had in there, and then on the development potential, probably soften that, I guess, a little bit, or explain a little bit more that it's not going to be happening. It's not going to happen next year. It's not going to happen. Who knows where it's going to happen? It might not happen for 10 years.
Might not happen at all. Level. This is simply, like I say, it's a mathematical exercise.
Opening the door for potential. That's all it's doing.
Right. It's enabling.
And do you have any examples of? I know there were other communities that Carol had worked with, and you probably worked with. We have examples of what that pace of development may have.
We could look into that. I mean, it's largely economically driven,
right? Yeah.
Based on what the economy is doing at any given time and what the level of interest is. I could do some homework on it and see what might exist.
Well, I know the businesses do really good the 4 weeks of, or 4 days of the fair. We've had kids that made $80 in one day.
Great. Like,
yeah. You only would have made more if you had more cups.
Well, like, that's not going to build out like in 20 years. I mean, that would be, you know, 40 years.
It could be.
20, you know what I mean? Just.
We're not just developing it. We're just,
no,
right,
I'm
we're
just
making
saying,
it available.
Yeah.
Okay.
The economy is going to drive it.
Peterborough might be a good one, Nate, to look at.
But in terms of the assumptions and you know, those assumptions make sense to everyone, the floor area ratio, the residential density.
I think it does give a top end look at it.
That's what this is. This is the max.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. It's not necessarily what's going to happen, but it's
It's basically the theoretical maximum. It's a mathematical exercise to determine the theoretical maximum, right, is really what it is.
Any other questions, comments?
Good job.
All right.
Last one would be, did I miss candy getting passed out at the very beginning?
Yeah.
Well, that's what happens when you're late.
You were late.
Technically.
And it was so good, too.
Yeah, but you missed puzzle lunches, so you were late.
The only other thing I think we're going to really need, too, is that this is really good, and the work that Nate is doing is very good. We will have to drop up a legally recognized document, too, to put in for the zoning amendment itself, or the zoning ordinance itself. So just be aware that we're going to have to really... Once this gets down here, to nail down what we want to put in as the ordinance. So.
I know we're close to our bewitching hour, and you guys have to start another meeting at 7. Yeah. I have November 6th held on my calendar for a public meeting. Mm-hmm. Is that still the plan?
I believe so.
I would say
so. Tentatively.
Yeah.
Schedule, we do.
You have that fiscal impact analysis done prior to that meeting, because that's something that we can look at the assumptions and the number of school kids and the number of bedrooms. I'm saying you really want to look, because I mean to me that's a key.
Yeah, I just didn't want to go down that path till the board. Correct. You know.
And just to clarify, it's going to be a meeting, not a hearing. On here, so we're going to present it to the public for what it is the proposal, and then once we get feedback from the public, then we can get down and draft the ordinance.
Sounds good.
And that's at 1800.
Are we going to do it at 6 o'clock, or should we do it at 7 o'clock?
We got other stuff on that night.
Well, actually,
we have the Tadalus Ranch roller coaster lot line adjustment.
We should probably do it at a planning board meeting, not a zoning review meeting. Mm-hmm. So, yeah, right. It should be the 7 o'clock meeting.
Okay,
then we can do it.
Or do we only just have the planning board at 6? It's just a matter of noticing it, right?
I haven't changed any time because I only have as of right now. I only have the lot line adjustment, which we're tweaking today.
Yeah.
So. And then I have tentatively to present this to the public, so I have 7 o'clock.
How about if something else comes up that she can put on it, then we'll go to the 6. If not, we'll just leave it at 7.
Sounds good, yeah.
So I will plan on 7 unless I hear otherwise.
Yeah, sounds good.
Right here in this room.
Yep.
For that one, I will need a screen if possible.
Yeah.
I know you guys do, just as a heads up. I'll bring everything else. I'll bring a projector and computer. Okay. And
all right, and... find some ways to get it out to the public so the public is aware of the hearing. We'll just have to figure out how to do that the best.
It'll be on the agenda, so it'll be on the website.
Right.
I'll see if we can do it a little bit earlier.
Should put it on the Facebook pages and stuff.
Probably social
post
media would be good.
Post it at the library, Photoshop, I can get it up too.
Yeah, okay.
Okay. Right, so the subcommittee can post social media?
Sure.
For Four Corners?
Yeah.
We'll just make a note of that.
I think we may want to think about another location for it as well. I don't know what you think the turnout will be.
That's a good question. Yeah, good point. Just in case, why don't you see if the school is available? The gym?
School gym for our presentation?
Yeah.
Okay.
That would make it easier for me. I'll be there at 4 o'clock, and then I can just stay there.
Oh, boy.
So, Lisa, if you do move the location, just send me an email or something as a heads up. Yeah, just so I don't come here.
Right?
Yeah, right.
Okay, I just don't know where I'm going.
Oh, okay. That's probably a good point.
That would be a good point. Yeah.
How are we going to know, though?
I guess we won't know. You don't have to RSVP.
Right.
Won't it be on the agenda when it's posted?
Yeah.
But
we have to decide. Time and place. We have to decide.
I think you should just tentatively do it at the school.
Yeah, why don't we? Yeah, I like that idea.
I'd rather have more space than
Playing on it being in school.
So that way it depends on how many people want to show up. They know what they have.
Right.
Since maybe we're going to do that then, do you want to have it at 6 o'clock? That way by 7 o'clock everybody can meet over here.
We'll just continue the meeting over there. We'll do it at 7. Yeah, we'll just do it everything over there.
Easy.
All right.
We can do that. The governor does it with his council, so we can do it, I think.
Is that too much stuff for you to lug around, Lisa?
More school. No. I'm a mom. I'm a multitasker.
All right. The meeting's running over a little bit, so I'm going to close the meeting. Take a motion to adjourn.
I'll motion to adjourn.
Second?
Second.
Okay, motion to adjourn is made in second. All in favor, aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Abstentions? Okay. Nate, thank you very much.
No problem.
Thanks.